Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, December 5th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, Futures Lab Director at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. With me in the RJI studio for our weekly critique of the news media, our Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. The murder-suicide involving a Kansas City Chiefs linebacker prompts a prominent TV sportscaster to sound off on gun control with predictable results. Meanwhile, reporters are digging into and speculating about whether all-too-common head injuries among football players could have played a role. The other shoe, and by that we mean another rape allegation, dropped on Michael Dixon last week. He's leaving the Mizzou basketball program and leaving us, at least for now, with unanswered questions about top athletic department officials. What did they know and what, if anything, did they do about it? The New York Post publishes a front page picture of a man about to be killed by a subway train. Critics are questioning the motives of the photographer and the paper. A British judge issues his controversial report on media ethics. Government officials, press defenders, and the public debate what should happen next. Rupert Murdoch kills off his daily iPad News app. Does it mean tablets aren't the golden goose for newspapers and magazines? And KBIA takes some good-natured ribbing for its plan to use drones. We begin this week with the tragedy in Kansas City. On Saturday morning, Chiefs linebacker Javon Belcher shot and killed his girlfriend. He then drove to the team's practice facility and committed suicide as his coach and general manager begged him to put down the gun. By Sunday, the media had unearthed most of the details and were turning their attention instead to the potential causes of the tragedy. One of the country's most prominent sports journalists, Bob Costas, focused on America's gun culture during halftime of NBC's Sunday Night Football.
You want some actual perspective on this? Well, a bit of it comes from the Kansas City-based writer Jason Whitlock, with whom I do not always agree, but who today said it so well that we may as well just quote or paraphrase from the end of his article. Our current gun culture, Whitlock wrote, ensures that more and more domestic disputes will end in the ultimate tragedy, and that more convenience store confrontations over loud music coming from a car will leave more teenage boys bloodied and dead. Handguns do not enhance our safety. They exacerbate our flaws, tempt us to escalate arguments, and bait us into embracing confrontation rather than avoiding it. In the coming days, Javon Belcher's actions and their possible connection to football will be analyzed. Who knows? But here, wrote Jason Whitlock, is what I believe. If Javon Belcher didn't possess a gun, he and Cassandra Perkins would both be alive today.
So, Lee, some say Costas should have stuck to sports commentary and kept his comments about gun control to himself, while on the other hand, people were saying he didn't go far enough. He was just quoting another journalist rather than putting his own opinions in his own words. So what do you make of those critiques?
Bob Costas is a little bit of an exception in sports journalism. People need to keep in mind that he won, and I believe it's either an Emmy or a Peabody this year for his interviews regarding the Penn State mess. And so he has more latitude, I think, to do some things in the same way that a guy like Kristoff has more latitude at the New York Times. I think this is his opinion. Journalists pick who they quote. Costas certainly picks who they quote. He had many people he could have selected from. He pretty much tells you that he agrees with this. And I think he has every right to say it and to say it in the venue that he did, which I think got to a lot of people who wouldn't normally have heard it.
Well, Charles, he certainly had to know he was going to stir the hornet's nest and he was going to get the kind of reaction that always happens when somebody talks about gun control. I mean, heck, the president and Mitt Romney wouldn't even talk about it. It was almost like the third rail of politics, and yet Costas at least brought it up, if not in his own words.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, as sad as it is to say, it was a courageous move on his part. I say sad because I think it is sad when our national discourse has reached the point when it's courageous for a sportscaster to paraphrase another sports writer saying that maybe we ought to think about handguns. If you actually go back and reread that statement that Costas aired, it couldn't have been much less condemnatory. It didn't assert any handgun controls. It certainly didn't talk about banning handguns. It talked about the sickness of gun culture in America. For that, he got the typical reflexive, spasmodic response from the NRA and its legions of followers who have been trained that no matter if someone mentions guns in a negative way, the response is always the same. It's always complete, catatonic, spasmodic, ritualistic. And I think what we have to do as a nation is get back into the discourse.
But of course, I mean, Lee, even some people who might have agreed with Costas or not violently disagreed with him like the NRA would make the argument that was that the, quote, appropriate time and place during halftime of a football game? Is there ever an appropriate time or place for a journalist to bring up something like that?
I was going to say, I get the argument, but actually I think it was an incredibly appropriate time and place. Yeah. I think if you had sat down and said, here are your options, pick the one where you think you will reach the most people, that's the one that he would have picked, should have picked, and I think it was utterly appropriate.
Well, the column that you put up on the blog from the NRA guy, I mean, it kind of is a – it's a hall of fame of all the NRA's greatest responses, which is, first of all, this isn't the time. Well, it's never the time, right? After Columbine, it wasn't the time. After Aurora, it wasn't the time. After this, it wasn't the time. Secondly, you're trying to take away all guns. That's always the response, right? Mm-hmm. We want to talk about assault weapons. We want to talk about handguns you can buy at Walmart. Well, then you're trying to take away Farmer Ted's, you know, long iron that he uses to take out the snakes. It's a ridiculous argument, but it's worked for them for, you know, 30 or 40 years.
I think the other thing that it reminds me of, and we've all had this experience, but I was, as people who listen know, I was a police reporter for many years, but in my first week on the police beat, I read a police report that basically went something like, so-and-so has been arrested because he had, in this case, a fight with his wife. He tells the police, I was having a fight with my wife. I look down at the table. There's a gun. I pick it up and I shoot her. And anybody who's been a journalist for, like I say, a week or longer has read this police report. So right. Costas is actually talking about something that goes deeply into my own personal experience of covering this sort of thing. And I agree with Charles. We've got to be able to get back in the discourse on this.
I guess I kind of wonder, Charles, if maybe Costas wasn't too quick to dismiss the other 800-pound gorilla in the room. And that was the possibility that concussions, which is really an epidemic in pro football, may have played a part in this murder-suicide, too. I mean, journalists had been quoting friends, for example, of the player as saying that he had head injuries, he was abusing painkillers and alcohol, and that it was wreaking havoc on his mental state. Now, I mean, again, a lot of this is just speculation, but don't we need to be talking more about that, too?
Absolutely. I think it was a little early in Costas's timeline, probably, to talk about that. However, you could say, deeply troubled individuals with incredibly ready access to handguns, maybe not best the best formula in the world, right? And for that, you will be pilloried. We've really reached a point of lunacy in this discussion to which I guess if I went in and said I'm against guns in prisons, I would be pilloried for it.
Okay, but let's talk a little bit more about the head injuries epidemic, because it really is, and it's moving down all the way into high school and even to younger football players, this whole problem of what we can do about concussions. And some people, some cynics would argue, Lee, that it's easier for the NFL and maybe some sympathetic sports writers to hang this tragedy just on guns, as that's more useful than trying to actually do something about the danger of head injuries.
So I'm going to say something horrifyingly academic. Reductionistic focus on single causes for complicated events almost never works. Academics think about it that way, but so do journalists. I think what Charles just said sort of sums it up. If you have a person who's troubled emotionally, physiologically, psychologically, giving them ready access to a handgun is not smart.
Right, but I'm not arguing that we don't talk about the gun control issue or the role of guns. I wanted to get your opinion about whether or not journalists have done enough or should do more more to talk about head injuries, which regardless of whether somebody has a gun or not, is a serious problem.
I think we should do more, but I've also seen a lot more in the past week. There have been a couple of medical studies that have come out that have made the national news both on the morning shows and in the evening shows where, okay, I hate to say this, but they've actually looked at people's brains after they die. There have been about 30 NFL players who have sort of willed their brains to this particular researcher in this particular project to try to determine in a physiological sense what's going on here. So, I mean, yes, we should talk about it, but we need to talk about it based on evidence. And I think the evidence from the medical community is not quite where it needs to be at this point.
Well, the day after we discussed another sports story, the rape allegation against Mizzou basketball player Michael Dixon last week, that story took another dramatic turn. A second woman came forward saying Dixon had also sexually assaulted her 2 years ago. And like the more recent accuser, she said that she had refused to press charges for fear of reprisal. She even quoted Dixon as saying he would kick her in the stomach and throw her down the stairs if she became pregnant. Well, Dixon announced he was transferring out of Mizzou. Athletic director Mike Alden, basketball coach Frank Haith, and a couple of assistants met the next day with a small group of reporters, but they essentially refused to comment on the most important questions, such as, when were they made aware of the 2010 allegations? What did they do about it? Why did it appear that they might let Dixon back on the court this season until some untimely Twitter post pointed journalists to those tawdry police reports? So, Charles, are journalists going to get those answers? Should they keep pushing for those answers? Or can Alden and Haith and others continue to, well, I'll use the word, hide behind FERPA, the federal regulation that protects student privacy?
Well, yeah, I mean, they can hide behind FERPA in about half of those questions, I guess. If they have to do with individually identifiable personnel, you know, if they are Dixon or the woman, and they are in response and they have to put those names in their response, they can't respond. So they are sort of over a barrel to some extent. And I read that very carefully, trying to think, okay, which of these questions legitimately are FERPA-driven non-answers? And I would say about half of them are. The timeline question that you raised in your lead into this discussion is a critical question and one that absolutely does not violate student privacy in any way. I would like the sports reporters surrounding the Missouri basketball team to laminate a card with about a half a dozen of those questions about the timeline and ask them every single time they get in front of these individuals for the rest of the year, because we have to know, ultimately, to move past this, we have to know how they dealt with that 2010
Well,
incident.
And Lee, I mean, it's obviously too dramatic and too early to compare this directly with Penn State, but didn't we learn something? Didn't university officials, didn't journalists learn something from that whole affair that might apply to this one?
The slope on the learning curve is not as big as I wish it would be. But I think Mr. Alden, among others, needs to realize that even that we're in a post-Penn State environment and that hiding behind FERPA is going to be seen just exactly as that. And compartmentalizing this sort of thing is going to be seen as a cover-up. What the universities need to learn is that because of what happened in Penn State, that every response to this sort of question is going to be seen through that lens. And the only way to get around that is to be more forthcoming. This is a place, I mean, I agree with Charles. Those questions should be laminated. They should open every press conference until they figure out that there's another response that they're going to give. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, I think we honestly need to go back and look at FERPA. There are some good reasons for that law, but right now it's being, I think, applied in way too wide a swath. So that there are some things that it doesn't really intend to cover that people are trying to use it as a shield for.
Right,
that was convoluted.
Example, right? I mean, it's supposed to cover educational records, quote unquote. What's educational about a basketball player raping or allegedly raping a young woman?
Well, and, you know, I guess you could say, Charles, on at least on the surface, there is something of a difference with Penn State. And maybe it's the reason that Coach Haith was, well, at best disingenuous in saying for weeks that his suspension, Dixon's, was for violating team rules, and that's the fact that no criminal charges were filed.
It was a tough, and really, in all fairness, Haith and Alden both in very, very difficult positions with the 2012 incident. And in fact, I think maybe they navigated that as best they could. But when I go back to the 2010 incident, I am deeply troubled because apparently, Coach Anderson, I guess it's the least of his worries now because he's down in Arkansas. Right. But as best I can tell from what I've read so far, he just flat out lied. He said that he was suspended for violation of team rules when there was a criminal allegation against this guy, and they would have never come clean with that.
I would think, Lee, also journalists have to be laminating this question, and that is whether or not the athletic officials thought and whether or not Chancellor Deaton, in fact, might have been on the verge of repealing Dixon's suspension. I mean, they took the guy to the Bahamas for a tournament. There was a lot of speculation that was going to happen.
I think there was a lot of speculation that was going to happen. These are tea leaves that I can't read. My particular friends across campus, when this all sort of bubbled up to the surface, said, among other things, boy, I bet this is something that Chancellor Deaton didn't sign up for. You know, what a horrible place to be put in. I sort of take some comfort from the fact that he was never allowed to play a single minute of a single game this semester, as at least some thread of hope that the penalties would have been exacted in a way that I at least think is appropriate.
You know, Charles, we like to say in cases like this that journalists can provide a teachable moment. For example, the Missourian uses the website Spotify this week to start up a discussion about rape and on college campuses. But, you know, we always say that. I mean, you can see the Costa story in gun control, and a cynic might just say that we rarely seem to learn very much that sticks.
Yeah, and we engage in behaviors time and again. And I mean, I'm not saying that this isn't tough. All these issues are tough. I mean, the athletic department is in a very difficult position, and I empathize. But ultimately, I think we all have to think about the sort of goal at the end is not only educating our own public and educating our students, but protecting them as well. And I don't think the young lady in 2010 was protected very well. And I don't think that outcome made anyone feel very good.
Well, another terrible act was amplified yesterday when the New York Post published a front page photo of a man about to be run over by a Manhattan subway train. The accompanying headline read in part, "This man is about to die." The victim had apparently been pushed onto the tracks by a homeless man whom police now have in custody. As subway patrons looked on in horror but failed to help, Ki-Suk Han, a freelance photographer waiting for the train, snapped the photo and sold it to the Post. When he was asked to defend himself, the picture taker, R. Umar Abbasi, insisted he wasn't looking for a great shot. He was, he claimed, firing off his camera's flash in an attempt to get the driver's attention. The Post's editors, as of our taping time here on Wednesday morning, have not yet defended their decision on running the image on the front page. Well, Lee, let's start with the photographer. Should he, as some critics suggested, have stopped taking pictures and tried to save the man if that was possible?
So I'm going to do an ethics thing here. I'm going to walk in his shoes. If I had been there, okay, wimp that I am, there is no way that I would have been able physically to save that man. I'm not fast enough, and I'm not strong enough. So I accept that it is entirely within the realm of possibility that he did all that he physically was capable of doing.
And he actually tried to deflect a little bit of the blame onto the other people on the subway platform who were even closer. They didn't do anything either, obviously, Charles.
Yes, and I mean, I think he has a valid point. All of us have been in a subway platform before, and you see where that picture was taken from, and you think about a train moving in real time. He was way, way too far away to get to that person. The flash in the train thing, That's his argument. It's sort of hard to argue with him because you don't know what was going through his mind.
Yeah.
But if he couldn't render aid.
We weren't in his head, but I have to say, if in fact that was exactly what he's doing, using his flash to get the driver, he miraculously framed that photo incredibly well. Well, the next question, Lee, is should he have sold the photos to the Post, and should the Post have paid him for them and then put them on the front page with that awful kind of rubbernecking headline, "This man is about to die"?
Okay, so the answer is that the reason the Post hasn't defended itself is because I think what they did is indefensible. They simply aren't going to be able to find any rationale at all for putting that photo on the front page. Why? First, it's a single death in New York. Really? That one is more front page worthy than everything else? Second, it's an invasion of the man's privacy. And probably it does harm to his family, which I assume is somewhere out there. And even though they may not have seen the picture, that they know it's out there. That's hurtful. Third, in ethics language, we talk about bad stuff driving out good stuff. Really, that was the most compelling photograph about the most compelling news event that walked across a desk at the New York Post that day? I don't believe it. So, yeah, should the guy have tried to sell it to them? I would hope not, but he, in my view, is far less ethically culpable than what the editors at the Post should be in line for.
Well, while we're talking about ethics, Lord Justice Brian Leveson, the judge in charge of that inquiry into phone hacking and British press culture, released a massive, what was all 2,000 pages almost, report last week. The findings are way too numerous for us to cover in detail. You can find them on the blog if you like. But Charles, Judge Leveson's most controversial recommendation is one that you telegraphed, and that is that we establish a independent body that can fine media companies up to £1 million for violating a new code of conduct yet to be written. Well, Prime Minister Cameron has refused to endorse that. Instead, he's calling on publishers to move quickly to establish more effective self-regulation. What do you make of the recommendation and the Prime Minister's reaction to it?
Well, I haven't read all 2,000 pages of the Leveson Report yet, but I read a lot of coverage about the Leveson Report, and most of what I read seems to portray it as posturing for the most part, rather windy posturing, but posturing nonetheless. Nobody really realistically thinks that they're going to move toward a regulatory regime that is government endorsed. Instead, they're going to create, and maybe this isn't such a bad thing, a self-regulatory regime. Lee knows much more about news councils than I ever will. But I know we attempted to experiment with them in the United States unsuccessfully, I guess, is what I would conclude. The difference there is, of course, a much tighter press that is geographically much more constrained and could literally meet in one room of the, you know, of the Hilton meeting room and get together and create such a council. Right. I don't think they have much choice but to do so.
Well, as Charles said, Lee, I mean, you've talked about in the past reasons why in America we really don't even talk much about formal self-regulation. But I wonder, I mean, especially with polls coming out, here was another one this past week showing that Americans trust the news media less and less every year. Are we sticking our heads in the sand there?
No, I don't think we're sticking our heads in the sand in this. It's almost the wrong metaphor. I think the reason we're trusted less has very little to do with phone hacking. I think the reason that we can't self-regulate is, go back 5 minutes in this conversation. There are papers in London who would have printed this photograph had it occurred on the tube. We've all lived there. We've all been there. We all know. So we're terrible at self-regulation. We're just awful at it. And what I struggle with, and I think Charles does the same thing, is there a mechanism that will make us get serious about self-regulation? And the only mechanism that we on this side of the pond seem to respond to is dollars.
You know, there are some critics that say that Judge Leveson deliberately downplayed another really important aspect affecting media culture and ethics, not just in Great Britain, but around the world. And that's the impact that technology and competition are having on the mainstream press. And we did see another sign emerging this week that indeed publishers, at least, are still struggling to cope with the internet and mobile media. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp announced it was killing off its iPad service, The Daily, after less than 2 years of operation. Now, Charles, more than 100,000 people were paying to access The Daily, but that just wasn't enough to sustain it. So what lessons do we draw more broadly about publishers and tablets?
That's a really troubling story because, like you say, they had over 100,000 readers. It shows you just how infinitesimal the revenue stream from such a product is and what sorts of economies of scale are required to generate profitable enterprises on the online side. I mean, we knew that already to some extent, but maybe this kind of pins the tail on the donkey to some extent.
I have to say, though, I hear that, and I know that nobody's generating big dollars. We talk about digital dimes instead of digital dollars right now. But, you know, The Daily, and I checked it out. I downloaded it, paid briefly for it. And my impression was that it just wasn't daring or indispensable enough to rise above all the competition out there.
there is an issue of cutting through the clutter, especially online, because there is so much content out there. And I think what everybody, you know, the holy grail is, well, can we do it behind a paywall? Can our reputation sustain an online product? Is there some magical mixture that will convince people that some of this stuff is worth paying for? I think the answer is we just don't I'm not aware of us having them. On the other hand, I have to say, my personal opinion, anytime a Rupert Murdoch product can bite the dust, I'm for it.
Well, I don't know about that, but I must say one of the more strange comments I heard in the past week, and it wasn't directly related to this decision, but the president of Hearst was at a symposium in New York, and he claimed that readers didn't want their tablet magazines to be interactive. They just wanted to read, damn it. And yet, you know, it seems to me that lots of recent studies show that people like to watch videos, news-related videos on their tablets. More people are using them as second screen experiences, firing up Twitter as TV programs are on. Advertisers are trying to make their online ads more interactive. So maybe print outlets just haven't figured out the formula yet. Now, of course, News Corp isn't the only mainstream publisher trying to generate revenue through subscriptions. There's some paywalls that are paying off and others that are not. I thought it was interesting that there's a TV station in Idaho now that's going after newspapers in its region with a new online ad called We Believe in Free.
That's strange. Those newspaper websites started charging for what used to be free. Better get out your credit card. Or not. At KTVB.com, we believe in free. And we give you more. More up-to-the-minute local news. More forecasts. More radars. More road conditions. More local sports. More shared photos and videos. But we won't ask for your money like the newspaper websites.
That's just wrong.
KTVB.com. Number one in Idaho for news and weather. And still free.
Now, of course, it's fair to say that most TV stations, their websites aren't rolling in dough either just yet. They still generate most of their money from TV ads. But, Charles, it's an interesting marketing strategy at the very least.
It's a differentiator in the marketplace. And they have a screaming eagle, too.
I do like the screaming eagle. Well, you know, last week we told you about that grant that KBIA received to experiment with rural news coverage using miniature drones. Well, clearly that story has wings, to use a bad pun, but papers and online news sites around the country really did pick up on the story. It was originally written by the Missourian, the AP got it, and that's all over the place. But we knew we'd really arrived when the report became the fodder for jokes on this weekend's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
NPR affiliate KBIA in Missouri say they want to fly an unmanned drone around to, quote, collect media. That's a lot cleaner, easier, more efficient than sending in Terry Gross to take them out hand to hand.
You'll be very whispery, though. Be very quiet.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm coming in looking at you. Very calm. No, but I'm curious on what it's radio. So what would they get in video footage?
Yeah, apparently they'd want, I mean, it's like a cheaper version of a news copter, I guess. I'm not quite sure what the idea was.
So you can blackmail people to donate.
Yeah.
We know what you're doing in the backyard. Call in the next 10 minutes.
So, Charles and Lee, I guess any publicity is good publicity. That was pretty good stuff.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
They did a good job. And I mean, it is kind of nice to know that something that we're doing here actually is capable of making a little bit of news, even in this way.
And we were really amazed. I mean, I've been involved peripherally with Scott Pham and his plan to put these drones into action. And it seems to me that we're really going to see some interesting results eventually. Well, thanks to listener Mike Beneke of Jefferson City. He's the one that called the Wait, Wait segment to our attention. If you have a topic suggestion, a question, or a comment, please email us at views@kbia.org. You can also post to our blog if you like. That's the same place you can go for audio, video, and links to our topics. Just go to the Talk Shows tab on kbia.org and click on Views of the News. Our program is recorded at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. RJI's Travis McMillan directs it. KBIA's Pat Akers is in charge of audio. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.